Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to ATP Radio with Barry Nussbaum.
Welcome to ATP Radio. I'm Barry Nussbaum. I'm very happy and honored to introduce our very special guest, all the way from Great Britain, but visiting us in the colonies, somewhere in the United States. We have Katie Hopkins, who many of you know as a very famous journalist and rabble-rouser from Britain, well-known on both sides of the pond as someone who is listened to by both the leaders of Great Britain, Boris Johnson, and our esteemed president, Donald Trump. Welcome to Katie Hopkins.
Thank you very much indeed. We were just discussing how you would introduce me, and I am conscious that these days, you know, what I think we all get a bit sick of, I'm sure your listeners do too, you know, when people say, oh, commentator and best-selling author. I always wonder, was there ever an author who wasn't a bestseller? This is all you ever hear, isn't it?
Well, you know, clearly you don't want to say an author, and God, I wish someone would buy my book. At that point, people are going, I'm not listening to this anymore.
Wouldn't it be great, though? Wouldn't it be great if people were introduced as, you know, really honestly? So this is Greg so-and-so, and he is author of the book, blah, blah, blah. And it didn't do as well as his publishers had hoped.
And he didn't even cover his advance, now he's doing radio.
Yeah, he asked Levin to write the foreword, but Levin said no.
Because it kind of sucked.
It would
All
be
right,
so
well,
great.
But you are a bestseller, and you are a big name. And I just got to add one more moniker, you know, that people probably know you by and don't know if it's a self-named or somebody stuck this tag on you, but biggest bitch in Britain. How many people can say that about themselves?
And that's that was a double, and I can still see it actually. If I think and shut my eyes, I could still see that. So it was, there's a newspaper some of your listeners might know actually, called the Daily Mail. And I guess you guys get dailymail.com. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's huge.
So way back, I used to be their columnist. But before that, way back when I'd done The British Apprentice, I became known as this. I didn't even know I was doing it. I was just really, really honest about what I thought about the other candidates to camera. And then, of course, once that show comes out and then you see yourself being very, very blunt about these people, that's how I got that title. And I remember seeing the double page spread, you know, with me and whatever, and that title running across two pages, the center pages of Daily Mail. And that was the newspaper that my parents also read and got. So it was like a moment in my life, like 10 or so years ago, whenever that happened.
Well, it's clearly unique and it has stuck. And you know what? Yeah. Sometimes they say good press, bad press, just spell my name right. So God bless you. It's very, enticing. And it certainly is not like everybody else's nickname. That's for darn sure.
I think there's that. I think there's also, you know, some people genuinely in the UK in particular, hate everything about me, and were brought up on a diet of being told by mainstream that was the only thing they were allowed to do was hate me because of my views. And so for many people, it's kind of a truth. And then for other people, it's kind of surprising because when they meet me, A, I'm not that big, so that everyone's always like, oh, you're really little. And then the other thing is I'm quite a regular married mom of three kids that just has an opinion on a lot of stuff. So I'm not quite what the moniker suggests.
Well, certainly. With that background, let's kick it off and ask you what you are doing in the United States. I know you're Zooming everywhere. Why don't you tell our listeners what's going on?
Yeah. Well, one thing I'm definitely not doing, Barry, is Zooming everywhere. in the sense that I know we're doing that now, but my genuine kind of plea to everyone is if you get the opportunity, get off Zoom. You know, Zoom, this sort of online conferencing chat facility, which I appreciate is helpful in some regard. But if you have the opportunity to say, let's meet face to face, please do. I consider Zoom to be the death of humanity, and it in no way replaces face to face meetings. Anyway, that was just my little ramble there, my rant, get that off my chest. I broke back into America. Brits are currently banned from your country because of our Wuhan flu record. So I broke back in because I was not prepared to sit at home and watch the fight for your brilliant president. I wanted to be a part of it, whatever that involves or whatever it involves now. It doesn't matter to me if it's litter picking or cleaning or whatever, whatever it takes, I want to be part of it. And so that's why I broke back in. And since I left my home over 3 months ago, I've traveled every day or every other day to a new place or state. And I actually thought it was going to be, Barry, about, you know, just campaigning for Trump. But actually, it's become something much more special in a way, because when I rock up, there's an excuse for people to gather. The crowds have been massive. Tickets, you know, some are free. So I'm not talking about the financial thing. Tickets have just sold out immediately because there is a thirst. Basic human level thirst to gather together and feel better. And that's actually what this trip has become, about making people feel a bit better about themselves and to remind people what it feels like to be in a room with people who actually our side just want the very best for each other. So actually it's become like a really joyful thing, much more like a church thing than a political thing.
And where have you been? And who's been sponsoring you?
Yeah, so I came on my own dime. So I spent 15 days in isolation in Barbados. And, you know, that I say my own dime, my husband, my children, and my dime. I'm grateful to have the support of David Horowitz and the Freedom Center at some basic level. Other people are good enough to maybe give me a contribution if I speak somewhere. But mostly I support myself by just, I don't know. You know, I really believe there's two things. One thing, the time for asking permission is over. I knew I had to come. I'm here and I'm still solvent. It's fine. And the other thing is there's much bigger stuff at play. Like I genuinely believe there's much bigger forces at play. So as long as I can, I'm not, you know, owing anybody any money. And as long as I can still stay and find food and do that, then I'm all good. I'm really only interested in your president getting 4 more years and sharing the, you know, news that British people are right there fighting alongside you. You can't hear us. You can't see us. The mainstream media won't articulate the views of regular Brits, but we're right here with you. And this feels epic. It feels like, you know, of all the people I meet, you know, the one thing we'll say often is that this is the time to be alive. And as I've traveled through California, through Minnesota, Dallas, now I'm in DC, tomorrow I fly to Palm Beach to help Laura Luma. It's an epic journey and an epic moment for an epic president. And I just love it.
And are you finding a sense of enthusiasm for President Trump that is out of percentage with Biden? I mean, I saw a press conference this morning where they've got Bernie Sanders, our most famous socialist communist senator of all time, doing a tour for Biden. And the caption was, crowd of tens turns out for rally for Biden. And I watched the speech, and he read a speech looking down the whole time, and somebody panned outwards. And I swear there was this huge field. And there were like 25 people. That's it, 25.
It's just absolutely, our side is awe-inspiring. So, I mean, it is just simply awesome how many people are rocking out, you know. So let me just, when I get to California, this is a month and a half ago. This isn't 30 days out. You know, this is a long time ago. Someone's backyard, 250 people. Redlands Tea Party, 220 people, standing room only. Murrieta Church for a pastor that's kept his doors open, Pastor Tim Thompson, bless his soul, running four, I went to each one of them and talked, four church services on a Sunday morning, 7 a.m., 9, 11, and 12, because that's the size of the congregation. So desperate are they to get to church. He's running four services. We've just put up tickets for the Lux in L.A., L.A., and those tickets sold out before we had a chance to promote them, and now the wait list is full. And that's just me. Like, I'm a no one, but it's the point is our side, the enthusiasm. People will have seen the rallies, the car rallies, the trucks. You know, our side is electric, and I think that's a little bit of it's trying to. It's almost like plugging in something. You know, when you plug in your phone, my job, as I see it, is to go around and get the end of the charger and plug it in to other people, because once you're charged and plugged into our network, you see how electric it is. When the Democrats keep you from being plugged in, when they keep you in your home with your mask on, don't go out, it's hard to plug yourself in. And that, I know that's how we're going to win this, is by keeping this energy charge kind of coursing through us. So yeah, I tell you, Barry, it's really, really exciting. And I have to say, with all the news coming out from, the corona pollution of our top team, that I think it's going to absolutely work in Trump's favor.
You may be right, and I want to get to that. And I'm going to delay a little bit question, because I'm reading updates constantly about his condition, so I want it as most up-to-date as possible. So let's go somewhere else. You did a video recently at a gun range in California, and you made a comment that you couldn't buy a gun no matter how much money you had, because they had sold out. And ammo is in very short supply. You can't do that in Great Britain, obviously. What's your message to the American people about the Second Amendment?
I suppose two sides. One is, yes, Americans are preparing. It gives me enormous confidence and a sense of shared courage that at a time when it's possible that after the election, all hell will break out, which I believe it will in certain places that I've been, that people are preparing for that. I find it enormously reassuring that every time things look a bit darker or the left become more radical, people go out and buy more weapons. So you just speak to the Glock manufacturer, number one Glock manufacturer in America the other day. You know, he said he could do 20 times the sales if he could get hold of the stuff to sell. So I love the fact that people are preparing. I love the fact that this country now has a stockpile of weapons and ammunition. And I think just for me, because we don't have this ability in the UK, we don't have a way of defending ourselves. And what you see is that the speed at which they take other freedoms from you, because we do not have a freedom to speak in the UK. We don't have, we don't have a constitution and a First Amendment, but we can't speak. You know, speech now is policed very heavily. Truth is classified as hate speech. And as a result, of course, I can be arrested for my opinions, and I am. I've been arrested for a column in a national newspaper. I've been held and questioned by Major Homicide and Crime Command, the most serious homicide unit in the country, for something I said about immigrants. And so it's because of your Second Amendment that you still have your First. And I think Americans, this is a moment in history, I think, speaking as a respectful outsider, where perhaps you're really feeling the force of why you're going to hold on to that Second Amendment. And I think this period in time has been very good for that.
Well, as a follow-up, you said that, you know, after the election, there may be upheaval and the value of owning a gun with commensurate ammunition supply is so important. Does that matter who wins in your mind as far as the importance of owning a gun come the second week in November?
I mean, speaking bluntly, these aren't necessarily opinions I think I would, they aren't things I go around pushing onto people, but being asked the question, when Donald Trump wins in November, as he surely will, I'm certain of it, There are places in this country where the only response that will the other side will know is to burn the place. And if I think of two examples, one would be some parts of California, but I'm reassured by the preparations there. My biggest fear, my concern, and the reason I'm going back actually to Minnesota is that in the suburbs of Minneapolis, near the area of George Floyd and the rest, Ilhan Omar territory, I'm very concerned for the men and women living in the suburbs there and who are not prepared, and worse still, in my personal opinion, have Biden-Harris signs on their front yard or even Black Lives Matter signs, imagining that that will be defense when the mob comes, and it will not. So I'm going back to Minnesota to try and I've written up some material that I'm going to hand deliver around some of the suburbs in Minnesota because I'm personally worried for them. I spent time at the George Floyd Memorial and the people there told me what they plan to do. They plan to rip down the 38th Street sign, plonk it in some of these white suburbs and do their damage. I think it's a reality. I think it's terrifying. But I think our side will emerge stronger ultimately.
Wow. Well, that's a ugly prognosis for a couple of neighborhoods. Hmm. Just real quick, for fun, you said you met someone from Glock. That wasn't Lenny McGill, was it?
Oh, I'm just looking on my phone as we speak. I don't believe it was, but it was someone related because he was talking about the manufacturing of the Glocks and the fact that he can't get can't get enough in. But the volume, and he's the number one manufacturer in the US, I believe. I'm just texting my friend to ask for his name. So I don't know the answer to your question, but I'm going to find out.
If he owns the Glock store, it's the guy I'm talking about, and he's the largest distributor. It's neither here nor there. Let's move on.
Okay.
So you've been all over the country since you've arrived, and obviously you're an outsider looking with very educated, experienced eyes at our country. What do you think is the biggest problem in America now that may be an issue in the campaign or maybe an issue to solve after, depending who wins? What would you say would be the top one or two issues that America needs to deal with?
Yes. I think number one issue, I only see this going one way. I don't think that's naivety either. I think I am an outsider and a foreigner, but the fortunate thing, I suppose, is when you're just on the road, on the sidewalks with people every day is, my conversations are those conversations of ordinary Americans. So you get a good feeling for the heart of the place. I think after Trump wins, as I surely believe he will, that there will be a kind of reckoning. Once he has four more years, there is no need now for the gloves to stay on. Those gloves can come off. I think never again in the future can America have a president who could be so undermined by people inside the institution that they're supposed to support. That has to be resolved, and I believe that's what's coming. I believe there's going to be an epic level clear out of the establishment that should be supportive of the office of president, regardless of the name of the individual there. And I think then on the same kind of thematic, law and order needs to be reestablished and reinforced. Reestablished because Democrats have removed it from many places, as we know, and reinforced because it will only take the lessons of a few areas and towns for people to realize that this game is up. So Portland would be an example, downtown Minneapolis an example. It is time for this country to go back to the principles of law and order that decent families need in order to be able to function. So I think these are fundamental things. These are massive things. But after the anarchy is over and quelled, I think that will be the time of that reckoning. And I think it will be cathartic and therapeutic. And that's the only future I'm willing to look at. Any other and all is lost. So yeah, that's my only way of coping.
So let me ask you this: if we were going to compare the U.S. to the U.K., our experience with slavery and anti-black laws even after slavery was abolished, you know, Jim Crow and whatnot, and all the prejudice in this country that, according to some members of the media, some politicians, and a whole lot of people rioting in the streets, this is the most racist country on planet Earth, at least in their opinion, that they want to tear down and reestablish in some sort of socialist communist utopia. Is there a Black Lives Matter movement in Great Britain as well? And if so, why, compared to the United States?
Yes, exactly. So the answer to that, of course, is yes, there is. And given what you've just said in terms of the summation of a political history and slavery that you know, so much more rooted, as we know, in America. The reason there is a Black Lives Matter movement, or the whatever terrorist organization, as I prefer, in the UK, and indeed in France, and indeed in Spain, and indeed is because that playbook was written. You know, it was scripted. This whole, however, you know, however much you want to indulge in conspiracy, I don't know, but I don't want to indulge in that too much. What I'll tell you is that the moment you had George Floyd, we had Beli Manunga, and in France they had another gentleman, and in Spain another name. All these names ready to go for different reasons. Our Lady, as it happened, died whilst working on public transport. So, but they had a character for each country in order to enable the mobilisation of the Black Lives Matter movement across Europe as well. So I think there's that. I think what's the joyous thing, and I always will always revert to joy, is that having just been here now in DC for the last 2 days with the Walk Away movement with Brandon Strack, you know, the majority of voices on that stage, I was a white minority, I think, but, you know, having black voices for Trump, Shamika Michelle, David Harris Jr., you know, these powerful black speakers that speak such elegant truths of how they feel about America and how they have hope under Trump. And then I take it down a notch away from the staging and the scripts to an Uber driver that drove me to the airport in Dallas. And she cried and she cried and she cried the whole journey because, A, she got a good fare, like the fare to the airport was enough to make her feel better, and then it all came out. And then B, she just felt like there was no hope for her. There was nothing for her. And she just needed to get back to work. And I think that's the truth of us all here in America or anywhere, is that what we all want is to get back to work, to look after our families, and to try to do the right thing. And I think that's what politics has come to. And I think that's where America has come to just at the right moment. And that people will be voting for the right thing for their country, but the right thing for their family. And that's nothing to do with terrorist organizations or inciting hate or defunding police or law and order.
Well, on that subject, you know, there's something that I have trouble understanding, and I know a lot of Americans do. When you watch the political commentary, and I don't necessarily mean just the mainstream media, because some of it is so wildly anti-Trump, they have become the opposition and the ally of at least the leadership of the Democrat Party. But in terms of political issues, if you go back before COVID, if you can remember, it seems like 12,000 years ago, but it really wasn't that long ago. The economy was on fire. Lowest unemployment for almost every discernible minority in American history. Rebuilding of the defense of the country, the wall being built, immigration, illegal immigration being cut down, new trade agreements. I mean, you can go on and on, not to mention, you know, incredible news about peace in the Middle East. If I was looking at that and I didn't know anything about the dynamics of this George Floyd thing and the riots, and Black Lives Matter, I would have thought that President Trump would walk into his second term in office in a landslide. I don't mean, you know, up by 2 points and he wins. I mean, you win by 5 votes and you're the president. But it would have been a rollover. I mean, like Reagan versus Mondale in our American history in the 80s. It was the biggest landslide ever. Why is that not happening now? Why does Biden have so much support? If you had to pin it down to a couple of things, here's a guy, hasn't been out of his basement very much, makes very confusing commentaries, literally, and I mean this, literally, is indecipherable. You can't, it's unintelligible what he says when he goes off script or dozes off or whatever, right? Why is the election looking the way it looks right now, notwithstanding your own confidence?
Yes. And I think two things. One thing, you know, we don't want to be sort of repeat old talking points in terms of, oh, the polls are always wrong. But I think most people lack the moral courage or the fortitude to be honest about their support for Trump until they are, you know, until they're alone with their vote. But I think also there was a sense of when people are uncertain, they will just give the right answer. And they've been told the right answer is to say the word Biden. But I cannot, even with my own levels of confidence, I can't find that Biden support. I can't see it. I can't feel it. The only place I see it that drives me slightly wild, having just come out of Dallas and one of the richest areas that I was staying in for just that happened to be that way, is these Biden-Harris lawn signs on these multi-million-dollar mansion. And there's just that thing about when people reach a certain level of affluence and wealth, they then consider it their something of a sort of a duty to then be an ardent leftist. Once they've reached the privilege of private healthcare, private schooling, private security, private home, private everything, they then want the rest for thee, but not for me. And it seems like they believe that's the right answer. And I suppose that's a theme that we see in the UK as well. You know, you're only allowed one certain opinion. You're only allowed to have the right answer, which is the narrative. And if you go against it, then they will take everything you have and everything that you are.
So let me drill down a little bit on that. Nobody who has an honest discussion can defend Joe Biden's mental acumen at this point. I mean, he won't have a live press conference, period. And the few times he's met with the press, there'll be four or five people who have been literally handed questions written by his staff and then have read those questions to him. You know, there is a euphemism for that, where they're throwing softballs, meaning it's very easy in the game of softball to hit the ball. It's so big, it's not really a challenge. They're not throwing hard, they're lobbing it to you. And even then, some of his answers are just gobbledygook.
I mean,
think about it. The fact that the most powerful person on planet Earth in American history and in world history is the president of the United States. And just the idea that our president, regardless of who or she or he is, goes to the hospital, worldwide stock market futures plummet off a cliff because the American leadership of the world is so prominent, important, and is relied on. How can people think a man that can't make a coherent sentence at times, who falls asleep on stage, who demanded a break every 30 minutes during the debate because he couldn't stand up supposedly, how could he be leading in the polls? Now, don't answer me in regards to the polling, but I mean the question more in regards to, do people really want him to be president, or do they really not want Donald Trump to be president? Maybe that's the better question.
Yeah, and I just don't see this lack of support. I'm not answering to the poll question. I don't see it. I think in the absence of being honest about voting Trump, they're just saying Biden. But I don't see the support. I can't see it. I'm looking for it. I can't find it. And you know what makes me sad, actually, is I don't like really talking about the Biden thing too much, which I know is a very strange thing to say when we're in a presidential election and we're 30 days out, but I don't like it because, you know, my dad is 74, and my dad's getting a bit forgetful, you know, and I would do anything to protect my dad. So if his memory or when it gets much worse, I will move my father into my home. I will protect him. I will not have anything harm come to my dad. And I find it emotionally upsetting that politics, I know politics is rough and gutter level and horrible, but I never like to reconcile that with the idea that that man is surrounded by people willing to see him humiliated in this way. Like I would love to get a hold of his wife. You know, I'm told that she's the one that's the, you know, desperate to be the first lady. I would love to ask her to her face, you know, is it worth it? What you're doing to a man, is it worth it? I just don't think a vet would do this to a dog, but that woman is prepared to do it to her husband, and that political party are willing to do it to one man. I find it really troubling, and I don't like it if there's any comedy around Biden, because I find it awkward, because I feel like we're laughing at someone we shouldn't be.
Well, you know, it's interesting on that, and it's not in a joking sense, but in a sense of concern, Katie. Mm. For months, when they were talking about who's going to win,
yes,
the Dem nomination and be their standard bearer, people were saying, geez, get Biden off the stage. He's embarrassing himself. He's not able to communicate, even in the debate. They're all annihilating him. And unless there is a, what's the right word, a safe environment with, you know, the questions asked ahead of time, and maybe he's on Adderall or whatever and no stress and he gets to rest, there's no chance he's physically, mentally, emotionally up to the concept of being on duty 24/7 with the nuclear codes next to his bed. There's just no way. And yet, there he is.
And actually, do you know, I think it's a real shame because actually, I think what we want from any kind of competition in life generally is a true competition with two great candidates or opponents. Or, you know, if you're running a race and you're an athlete, surely you want to run against the fastest person you can. You know, we want to bring the best, right? That's the old idea of competition, isn't it? You bring the very best. And I think politics has got such a long way from that, hasn't it? It's a load of cunning and manipulating snakes in the grass. And so we've come a very long way from competition creating the best. And that's such a pity. I mean, that's true in our school systems as well, of course, where everyone's a winner these days. But it seems a great pity. But I think to reflect, Barry, on your earlier point that you made, was that I remember that time you were talking about when we were winning so hard, it almost hurt. And I say we in the grand sense that you had Trump and your economy was on fire. And in the UK, we had Boris, and Boris had bowled into office and said, we are going to get Brexit done. And he was on fire. And we had Salvini in Italy turning back the migrant boats. And we had, you know, Orban and Hungary and Poland standing up and saying, no, we're not going to be overrun. Like, we were in such a good place and we didn't even celebrate it hard enough. I really feel that. And they say that about life, don't they? They say, you know, you never appreciate your health until you don't have it. I think we do that politically too. You know, we don't appreciate how great we had it. And we never, ever would have conceived 2020 would get this dark.
Boy, is that the truth. You made some comments about Australia. I think it was on your YouTube. I've always thought of Australia, and maybe because I've never been there, but maybe it's because of its reputation as sort of this free country, and they're the pioneers in the South Pacific, and they're this hard scrabble people with, you know, the home of AC/DC and rugby. What's going on there with their reaction to COVID? It's like they've become almost Stalinistic. Am I catching that story correctly?
Yeah. Yes, you're dead on. You're dead on the money. They are, you know, if you think of an example, well, actually, there isn't an example in the US that is as draconian or as drastic. Possibly the closest you'd come are parts of California, I suppose. But yeah, certainly you're right in your interpretation of Australia. There was this sort of idea of the Australian dream, you know, this, oh, we're all on the beach having a great time and we all used to be criminals, so now we're just going to live large. Like, you know, like the effervescence of Australia. But sadly, there's particular, you know, Melbourne and Victoria is very, very leftist. And the guy running that, Dan, has used this as an opportunity to utterly castrate a population to the extent that, you know, you have to be, the curfew at night is extreme. You're not allowed out of your home. You're not allowed more than 5 kilometers from your home. Under curfew, you're not even allowed out the door. A man was interrogated by the police for putting his bins out, you know, at the end of his yard. And then we've got, you know, examples of pregnant women being arrested in her own home in front of her children because she so much as posted something on Facebook about resisting the lockdown or, you know, an anti-lockdown party. I mean, the level of draconian is off the chart. What's more frightening, and it's something we've seen in the UK as well, is the passing of laws that concentrate power in the hands of these leftist lunatics. And make it such that, you know, it is a truth right now in New Zealand as well that police can enter your home without a warrant. They can detain you without a warrant and they can hold you in isolation and they can separate you from your children. Now, all of those things happen under this sort of Corona Act, but you just get take away the Corona Act and the fact that no one's dying. They can now take you, separate you from your children, you know, and hold you. How is that different to what the Chinese do to their Muslim population or whatever? You know, how far are we off from being put in camps? I do wonder. I genuinely do wonder.
You know, it reminds me of this analogous situation in San Diego many years ago. They wanted to build a bridge from downtown San Diego to the island of Coronado where the Navy was headquartered instead of taking the ferry or driving around. And people were saying, well, if we pass this bond and the bond gets paid off by a toll, the government never lowers taxes after raising them. And once the toll's in place and the bond's paid off, we'll never get our freedom to go to Coronado again for free.
Mm-hmm.
Well, turns out, I don't remember the years, it was like 25 years later, the bonds are paid off and people start saying, take down the toll booths. Well, guess what? The government said, well, now we want to use the money for blah, blah, blah. I think it's just like what you're saying, these draconian laws that nobody would have ever okayed in their right mind but for the life or death COVID-19 threat. Well, they'll be used for the next disaster, I'm putting that in quotes, or the next emergency in air quotes. And that's what concerns me, and I think that's what concerns you, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, in New Zealand, for example, Jacinda Ardern is the name of the leader. They picked a really good one there. They did that thing they do where they find someone, you know, motherly and womanly and personable. She managed to get these draconian laws that mean police can enter your home without a warrant and you can be arrested by any member of her lynch squad, not even police officers. She got those passed within 24 hours. They didn't go through normal process nor procedure. There was no sort of, you know, discussion of them. They were just forced through. And they basically took powers that were formerly separated and concentrated them all in her hands. So you're absolutely, you know, you're exactly right. Is I think there was that initial sense of, oh, gosh, let's do something. We must get something done. And when people hear about deaths and pictures of ambulances and then mobile furnaces that we saw pictures of, you know, crematoriums needing to be bussed in, this sense of, right, we need to get stuff passed and get it done. But of course, you know, 8 months on or however many months on, and now we start to see that things weren't quite as we were told. And it was never about flattening the curve. And nobody under the age of 60, sorry, is really affected, and And suddenly these laws don't make sense that they had to be rushed through. And it certainly doesn't make sense that they're still being extended. And it's a minor miracle of the mainstream media that things like flatten the curve have just been almost disappeared from the narrative. You know, it's almost as if that was never said. It was never, you know, as if flatten the curve was just a lie that was a moment in time and just disappeared, like almost like Snapchat for kids. That it's become like that, inconvenient truth erased from the collective memory in order to...
Well, it's as if the press has become an arm of the government's propaganda ministry.
Yes. Exactly.
Not even news, but it's propaganda for the purpose of changing public opinion to where it needs to be.
Yes, yes.
So we've got a viewer question for you as a Brit, and of course with your role as the biggest bitch in Britain, you're eminently qualified to answer this. You mentioned before that you very much want Trump to be reelected. If he stays in office for four more years, what does that do for the UK?
I'll be able to sleep. So that would be nice. B, I won't wake up. I'm sure other of your listeners will understand this feeling that you wake up as if you've been underwater and then are coming up for air. And I find it more and more at the moment. I wake up like this and then I'm like, oh, no, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. So A, that will stop. B, it will be hope for us. So whilst I am certain of the fact that my country will fall, and I'm certain of that because demographics alone show that will be the case. In 10 years' time, Muslims outnumber all others, and I'm a minority everywhere, and my children are already a minority in primary schools. So I know we lose our country, but, you know, America lives on. And there was this little story, if I may, of back in the day, America came over to the UK and took, we used to have good wine, and you took our vineyards in order to plant, you know, California and other regions. And you became, of course, the wine experts. But one time in the UK, I believe, there was this huge fire and all our vineyards and everything were wiped out. And we came over to America to get new shoots from your plant to replant and replace our vineyards. And that's exactly the analogy that I draw for Judeo-Christian culture as well, is that there will be a time of great separation. My Jewish friends will leave Paris and London. They return to Israel and they look for a safe place to call home. Our British people will do the same. We're pulling back to the coastline and eventually we'll move to Hungary, Poland, Croatia and Eastern Europe. But one day we will come back to America to try and replant the seeds of our true Judeo-Christian culture, and we will win it back. But not in my lifetime, I'm certain. But I see it here in America too, this retreat to defendable space. That's a bit dramatic, but people will be able to see the silent mass movement of people to states where they feel more like they belong or more like a place they can call home. And actually, it's one of my big kind of callings now to people that are maybe still uncertain of how to vote, is it doesn't matter who you hated in the past. It doesn't matter who you voted for before. What you need to do, I think, now is come home, because our side helped people feel better, you know, have a future you can feel better about. So for me, this coming home idea is massive on all scales, but come home to our side and help people feel better, and then we can make sure America stays great.
Well, let's talk about leaving the country. Your friend and a hero to many free Americans, Tommy Robinson, said he's leaving the UK for Spain. And I've never thought of Spain as the bastion of freedom, certainly not under its socialist leanings, and Tommy Robinson will feel safer in Spain than in Great Britain?
Yes. I mean, absolutely, he's safer in Spain than Great Britain. In Great Britain, and this has always been true, I think it's true of him and myself as well, one day they'll get either of us or both of us. You know, it's not, Tommy Robinson will not survive being in the UK. You know, they come for his house, come for him in the night. They've come for his wife's kids, his wife, his car, his kids at, you know, at venues that they go to. And I think the same is largely true for me in different ways, but also the same. I think probably Spain seems like an easy, I'm so sorry for that noise. Spain seems like an easy option for him, probably because, you know, it's a language that he understands. And he's made, I suspect what he's made more is a sort of a cocoon of safety for his family. And he's sort of hiding out there, you know, more like a little, an igloo of safety. In terms of how he proceeds and where he'll eventually live his life, I don't know. I know that he would like to do that in America. I know that he can't come here for various reasons, including, you know, he's not always had a clean sheet that's been whiter than white. So I suspect what he's just trying to do is self-preservation at this point. And he can see that there's better chance of self-preservation in Spain, which absolutely there is.
Interesting. So you've been to Minneapolis, we talked about that, and you've looked at just the devastation. Mm-hmm. It looks like a giant from outer space stepped on neighborhoods and then set it on fire, mm-hmm. you know, like some kind of terrible movie. Is that because Minneapolis is just radical, or is it a combination of Keith Ellison, you know, infamous ex-congressman, first devout Muslim to serve in the Congress, is now attorney general, and huge Muslim population that hates big time the American freedom of religion and the separation of state, and many people there can't understand why Sharia is not the law of the land. Do you see any link between what the demographic is there and what has happened to that physicality?
Mm, yeah, I mean, and it's so, it is so dark there. And I say that coming from the UK, you know, I think it's, it was upsetting, I think, for me at a personal level, because this is America. So, you know, and I feel so free here so often, so overjoyed with so many things, that I found Minneapolis to be so upsetting, because I felt much of the UK right there. And if you take the example of London and the UK, London is a Muslim-controlled zone. And as a result, London now, it has the ear of the world. It's as if Sadiq Khan, the Muslim mayor, speaks for England. Whereas, of course, it's just that London is Muslim majority and the Muslim mayor. And so it speaks London's truth, which isn't ours. And of course, that's true in Minnesota, because Minneapolis is this nightmare of epic proportions, but Minnesota is red, and yet Minneapolis gets to speak for, you know, downtown gets to speak for the whole state, and it's not the truth of it at all. I think what's so upsetting is just, and I went to Cedar Riverside, where all of these families are piled in high on these buildings. I won't tell you what the police force calls those, but it's not pleasant nor polite, but it's the truth of the matter. A whole vast population with little to do, hanging around, huge numbers, all voting according to religion. And what I know from London and all of our towns and cities that are now controlled by Muslims is that you infiltrate and swarm and flood an area with a Muslim population that reproduces at three times the rate of any other. You've got your votes then that are according to whatever they're told by the mosque. You will never return power outside of Muslim hands. Hence, you had Keith Ellison passing to Ilhan Omar, and then that monopoly just continues. And then I think with the fracturing that went on with Black Lives Matter, it was just, it's a community that's utterly lost, even downtown. So I stayed in a relatively, new apartment building. I'm sure it's supposed to be filled with affluent Asian and aspiring, you know, singles, and it was empty apart from me. There's no one on the streets, which makes it very weird when you go out. I watched black men go up to diners outside, a couple of people bravely trying to eat or return to normality, go up, grab food off their plates with both hands and walk off nonchalantly down the road eating it. It is an utterly lawless place, and the right answer is black or Muslim or other, and the wrong answer is white. And I think once that becomes right and wrong, it's going to take a very long time or a meteor to correct that place.
You're talking like it's a dystopian reality, and it's already manifested.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I can't tell you. I went to Walmart to buy a wardrobe to be able. I mean, you know, I go to dark places, and that's my job as I see it. And I walk to the George Floyd Memorial. I went to Walmart to buy an outfit first so I wouldn't stand out. On the way back, a guy tried to stop me to get anything I had. I knew then, and I've been to some places, I knew that my reaction mattered to whether I would be all right or not. And this is the center of downtown Minneapolis. You know, and I'm not one for exaggeration. You know, people have seen footage of me doing other things. It is dark, and you're not going to walk around that place on your own, and you certainly shouldn't be out there. I would not allow anyone that I cared about to go there. It's really dark. And of course, no media have the balls, excuse my language, to go there. So it's not really being shown. They just show pictures of the George Floyd Memorial, like it's obscure or isolated. There's a whole place that's utterly lost. It is really dark, Barry. Honestly, I came away really upset. I rang my husband, that doesn't happen often, to sort of say, guys, you know, I wanted to get out of there. Having said that, I'm going back.
You're amazing. What would you say? Here's another question from one of our listeners. The world economy was blown up, and then whatever's left of it has been decimated. There's virtually nothing near normal worldwide for trade, manufacturing, retail sales, wholesale, even the transfer of normal commodities, farm goods and oil and so on has been disrupted. The world economy has slowed down faster than anything seen in world history. In the United States, since Trump has been pushing to open back up, there has been record growth, but we've got a long way to go. If you had to make a prognostication for the recovery of the world's economy, this is somebody asking this question, what would you say to her?
Yeah, so the recovery of the economy will be a selective thing. China is obviously using this to steal a march and power ahead. The recovery will be strong in states where, once Trump has the win, and also states that have been led by great governors or great leaders. So Florida is a good example of places that can be opened up quickly and will be able to recover. And other places will be left to fall. The UK is a good example of that. For many of these leaders, for whatever is in it for them, the managed decline of their country is as profitable and easier than trying to fight for what's best for a country. That's why the UK has been falling for 20 years or so. It's far more profitable for British government to churn profit off the back of human flesh, bringing Muslims to Europe, than to try to reboot the economy. So the flood of people will continue to come. So I think what we'll see from an economic recovery is the bright lights will grow bright and quickly and fast, and people will be drawn to them, rightly so. And in places where the darkness has already taken hold, UK, South Africa, the darkness will come more quickly. And I think that's, you know, the thing I would say always is that our side is the resilient side. Our side is the side that's been through stuff before. Decent Americans with their weapons, their willingness to graft hard, to work hard. And I think that's what we need to do is start to, you know, really, we're going to join up and work hard together to try and find a way through. And what worries me as well, apart from, you know, I know this wasn't a question about the economy, and there will be states that we'll be moving to. People are on the move. I can't tell you how many people I meet here that are on the move. They're looking to move to the states that they think are going to make it. Is that we're losing so many people. You know, I was with a family in Minnesota. They just lost their 14-year-old son, walked out in front of the train because the season that he was depending on to be selected for the American football team that he was due to be on had been missed. And without that future, he couldn't see a way forward. So I think it's one of the other things for our side, Barry, is trying to get people to hold on. And I keep kind of asking people to hold on to something special, like find a memory or something that you really liked in your life and hold on to it. because one thing that we do know for sure is that this will pass. And we may not ever return to normal, I think that's true, but we will find a way of getting through this. And I think what we'll also find is that people who are like-minded and like us will gather more tightly than before and will move to be with each other. And I think that will be a really, really good thing.
Well, on that subject, do you have any optimism for the UK? I mean, you mentioned before that eventually Brits will go to the coast and then go somewhere else, Hungary or whatever, that they seem to feel safer to be able to exist and be able to speak and raise their family in relative security. Is there anything the UK can do to get you back there and feel comfortable, or do you feel it's hopeless?
I think two sides, because obviously I'm not a doom monger, even though I have this certainty that my country's fallen. And, you know, let's bear in mind, I come from the military. I signed up to fight for my country. I love my country. So there is no, sometimes I feel disloyal by saying the truth of it. We are overrun already. All of the scaffolding and the fundamentals of the takeover are there. A Muslim police association, a Muslim system of law, Muslim courts, Muslim housing, it's all there. So we're gone. But of course, there are moments of jubilation and triumph where we still roar pretty loudly. 17.2 million people, voting for Brexit. Boris Johnson win on the 12th of December last year. Still moments of hope. And of course, I am grateful for all the support I have in the UK. But I'm thinking the separation of individuals in the UK will become more stark. The pullback to communities, gated communities, people that can live inside areas that they can secure amongst their own. We will follow the South African trajectory on that. We will create islands within an island that we can feel safe amongst. That's what's coming.
Lovely. So as an alternative for Katie and family,
yes,
a viewer wants to, the listener wants to know, would you or could you immigrate here?
Yes. So absolutely, I want to get the children out. I think there's definitely, you know, I mentioned I am hunted in the UK. And I think what's happened with the latest movements and Black Lives Matter and the sheer numbers against me in terms of the demographics is that when I am got one day, if I am, there is a legitimacy to that. It will be seen as, well, she had it coming. And we really feel that at the moment. My husband has been a bit, you know, has been acutely aware of that. I'm underplaying it slightly. So I would like to get my children out to safety. I certainly can't claim asylum in the US because diplomatic reasons mean that the US would never infer that the British police can't look after a member of the British national citizenry. But I think there are ways I can apply for legal immigration. The only thing, of course, is that I will fight for my country and I can't leave it. I will stay there whenever that end comes, and also my parents are there, and I wouldn't leave my parents. But I would love for my husband and my children to be able to get out, and we are looking into that to try and find a way of doing that. And obviously, I wouldn't want to articulate that I want to pay my way. We want to pay our way, and we want to do it properly, and we want to, you know, do it respectfully. But I do need to get the children out of the UK.
And is this a near-term thing, or this is eventually?
No, this feels near-term. Yeah, I would say within 6 months it would be an ideal time to be able to get them out, only because waiting is sort of fraught, is laced with, regret is, you regret and repent at your leisure, I think. And with children, you can't afford to do that. So, these things are a little dark, but these aren't things that I talk of when I'm with groups, in the sense that we don't go into the minutiae of it, or I have no sympathy or pity for myself. I think the more important thing is that we focus on the big picture I'm just one thing. You know, the big picture is America and American freedom. And that's what we're all in this fight for. And that's what makes me so confident, because, you know, this is biblical in scale. And I know that we're on the side of the right. And I still believe, Barry, we're going to win.
Well, we're going to save that discussion till the end, because I got a monster question for you. But in the meantime, I want to ask about China, because in the news the last couple of days, there are certain people still thinking China is all that to America, in spite of the current COVID-19, the Wuhan virus, and before that, half a dozen other ones, not to mention spying and stealing of state secrets and belligerency in the South China Sea and threatening the United States militarily and with espionage and so on. Do you think it should be part of the American political scene? This is a question that just came in, that America should stand up to China. And if so, how would you respond to the people that say that xenophobic, you don't like the Chinese people?
I think we're quite over labels. You know, I think we got over labels a long time ago. It doesn't matter if you call me xenophobic or Islamophobic or any of those things. You know, I'm done with labels. I'll take your label, and then if you'll, you know, argue my point. So I think we do have to stand up to China. I think the trick is how, because the, you know, any kind of engagement with China won't be according to the normal playbook, as we're living through, and as has been demonstrated spectacularly well by China in 2020. So I guess the question is not so much how should we stand up to China, it's how. And the how is not some sort of usual military, it doesn't sit in the field of military, it sits somewhere else. I think it sits certainly economically, and it certainly sits with allies that will stand up against them. But yeah, we've seen how effectively they'll use other forms of warfare to achieve their political ends. And, you know, that's without us seeing much in the way of sort of tech-based warfare that, you know, that they're perfectly capable of, or at least we haven't seen much evidence of that in the wider public. So, yes, I think maybe that's where this alliance is with, you know, Trump pushing so hard with Israel, looking at the Middle East. You know, the balancing of power will be an interesting thing, but that's the way, I think that's the only way to push back on China, is to make it such that the power is on our side and not theirs. But they are terrifying. I think Chinese government and their attitude, their mentality is terrifying, and not wishing to be culturally inappropriate. But I have to say, you know, at the level of the individual, I'm talking about myself, like I'm lots of very bad things. I'm annoying, I'm over-talkative, I'm over-excitable, right? I'm all these bad qualities that actually, you know, that's who I am. I find that when you have the Chinese mentality, their adherence to rules, willingness to repeat and comply and follow the regimen, and, you know, a culturally very subservient. You know, you see that in schools, you see that in the way that they will go at something until they become genius at it, just because that's what they're programmed to be like. I find that culturally very awkward as well. So all those different levels, yeah, not. I think we do need to stand up to China. I don't think it's as simple as standing up and pulling out a weapon. Yeah.
Well, I've saved the best for last. And I'm not going to ask you to do it in a sentence or two. We have a few minutes. You were suggesting that you believe, contrary to every single poll, Donald Trump will be reelected in a month. Tell me why.
Yeah, Donald Trump will be reelected on the 3rd of November or date thereafter. And it will be because this election is not an election of politics. This is no longer about red or blue. This is not about Republican or Democrat. This is a moment in time that's about doing the right thing. It's a moral calling to a people to do the right thing at the level of their own family. If you want to be able to defend your family, if you want to be able to protect your family, pay to work and therefore earn money to pay to feed and house your family, you have to vote for the party and the person that's going to be able to protect that for you, and that's Donald J. Trump. And the parallel is very clear with the UK. Just as we had Brexit, we weren't allowed, and then you had Trump, you weren't allowed. On the 12th of December, even in my country, which will fall, people came out and they voted not with political party. A place in the UK called the Red Wall, which is our Democrats, our Bernie Sanders types, they came out and they voted, you know, their grandfathers' fathers have voted Red or Bernie, but they came out and voted Boris Johnson because it was the right thing to do for the country. And that's precisely what's going to happen in America. People will vote for the right thing for the country. And beyond that, there are places that will burn. The left will burn down parts of America, New York, NYC, parts of California, Minneapolis. But that cleansing has to happen. There will be immediate and draconian measures brought in, and there will be some sort of rebalancing of America. And I think when all the smoke and the dust and the debris is cleared, you know, a new way forwards for America with law and order at the heart of this country and your constitutional freedoms put back where they belong.
Well, you're making the case as a campaign advisor urging slogans, which, by the way, sound quite good. But you're not answering the question, which is, I didn't ask it this way. Every single national poll shows Biden ahead, popular vote and electoral count, which matters, and that lead is growing. Why do you think those polls are wrong?
I think because those are the polls. They, you know, this idea that we would trust the media with anything at this point is absolutely bizarre. We cling to rational for some bizarre reason, in the same way that Brits clung to democracy even when we were shown we couldn't have it. We keep looking for rational answers. People still ask me, why were you removed from Twitter? Like there'll be a rational answer. There is no rational answer as to why pollsters and the media are prepared to lie to us, other than they believe it will help keep people from voting, help keep Biden supporters voting, and repress the Trump enthusiasm. That's why those polls are doing what they're doing. I don't believe they're based on fact nor science. I don't believe they're based on anything actually being counted. I think they're just another manufactured way of telling us things that we're supposed to think so that we feel down and depressed, don't get together, don't group together, and don't go and vote. I think it's a tool being used by the opposition, just like COVID's been used by the Chinese and whomever else, just like it's been used by Democrats to shut down cities, just like it's been used to destroy America. You know, if politicians are willing to destroy America in order to get the team they want in, they're sure as hell willing to make up some nonsense about polls.
Well, I'm not even sure if the nonsense has to be made up. You know, there's a lot of evidence that I'm reading more and more of on a daily basis, which is there are certain ways to poll if you have an answer in your mind that you want to get at after you've expended whatever amounts of money it's taking to get there. In other words, if you oversample Democrats, you undersample Republicans, then what happens is you get literally the answer you would expect, quite frankly, from people that are already more Democrat than Republican in your sample group. So if you have 100 people you're going to poll and you want to get an honest answer, you ought to have a proportional number of Republicans and Democrats to find out how they're going to vote. But if you sample 60% Dem and 40% Republicans, is it any wonder that Biden's up 9 points? Well, no, not at all. It's like going to a Biden rally and asking them, 13 people in attendance, who do you want to vote for? Well, you're going to get 10 out of 13 to say the guy in front of the room that looks kind of sleepy. So if all of the polling is being done that way, you're going to get a different answer. And it's curious because some polls are out now today. James Ogbey's poll is an example where he's very careful in his polling criteria to be asking equal amounts of Republicans and Democrats. And when he does, he comes up with a race that's within the margin of error. But if you look at the NBC poll that came out today, it's going to be a landslide. I mean, it's going to be the biggest lopsided electoral college landslide in history.
I suppose, the joy I have, and it's a joy I'm choosing as well, and I don't wish to appear ignorant, but equally I don't believe I'm being informed better by the TV than by my own eyes. I just don't see it. I don't see it at all. I don't turn on all of that nonsense, but I just don't see it. I don't believe it, not for one second. I believe it's a complete contrivance. Out on the pavements, on the sidewalks, in the places I go, we have got this.
Tell people quickly, Katie, where they can find you, follow you, support you, please.
Yes. Well, it's tricky. I mean, it's got a lot more tricky to find me these days because, of course, we're all being removed at speed. But you have a platform called Parler. So you call it Parler, P-A-R-L-E-R. I would call it Parlay. But Parler, anyway, I'm at capital K, capital T, Hopkins. People can find me there or on YouTube. I'm on YouTube as well. People can find me at Katie Hopkins Official. So I'm kind of around. It's kind of easy to find me if you Google me, although a lot of the Google stuff is pretty unkind. But Parler is the best place to keep in touch with me or for me to keep in touch with people about where I'm going to be. And next up in my journey, I head to Palm Beach and to help Laura Luma with her campaign, do some fundraising for her. And then I head up to Northern Florida to a place that I can't pronounce called something like Alachua.
Okay, I have no idea what you're saying, but I'm sure
A-L-A-C-H-U-A. Alachua? How do you say that? Alachua.
I don't know. It sounds know. Like
it sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounds like a place that really is there. I believe you. So I want to thank you for coming on today. I'm sure that our audience appreciates it as well. And for any of our listeners that haven't subscribed yet, please sign up for our text message alert system so you can get shows like this one with Katie and everybody else we do radio and television with simply by taking out your cell phone and texting the word TRUTH, T-R-U-T-H. Send it to 88202, push send. You'll be automatically subscribed. It's always free. You'll see Katie and Barry and Annie and all of our supporters from ATP. Katie, thanks again for coming on. I sure appreciate you squeezing us in as you're saving America for us. And, I wish you nothing but safe travels and happy times while you're visiting our wonderful country.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's our pleasure. So for ATP Radio, thanks for joining us. I'm Barry Nussbaum.
You were listening to ATP Radio. Make sure to text the word TRUTH, T-R-U-T-H, to 88202 to be notified of our future radio shows.